Good morning. So last time we talked about some various types of trees. We spent most of our time talking about red-black trees, which were same idea as ABL trees, but a different way of achieving similar goals. So ABL trees, our goal was the tree always remains balanced, and we did it in a very direct way where we actually tracked something which directly says how unbalanced are we at this point in the tree. And track that for every node. In red-black trees, we do that, but we do this in a very indirect way, where we track this color, and we have a bunch of rules saying when things can have particular colors. And it turns out, if you look carefully at what these rules mean, in particular the rule about how many black nodes you could have going from some place to a leaf, they all have to be the same, that rule meant that we limited the amount of imbalance, and we did it in a less strict way than AVL trees. And in order to maintain these rules, we need to have a whole bunch of carefully analyzed cases in our insertion algorithm, and if we actually went into the details in our deletion algorithm, to make sure that we always obey all the rules. So we'd have to, if we were doing this formally, write a proof saying, assuming all these rules are followed beforehand, after we do these procedures, I can show you that always all the rules will still be followed. And probably the big reason we talk about red-black trees, besides showing you that AVL trees aren't the only option you have, is that these are what's typically used in practice. Because they support having the tree a bit more imbalanced, they do less rotations, and it turns out, in practice, those end up being expensive. And this means that when you're measuring real performance, red-black trees tend to do better. They also track a little bit less state per node, since it's one bit of information instead of two, or maybe three if you want to have -2 and +2 be possible values for your balance factors. So that's why you'll come across them in practice. If you look in the library on our lab machines at the tree implementation, which you probably won't because the code is really ugly because it's all template code, which is extremely generic. But if you look at that and figure out what it's doing, it's a red-black tree. So we also talked about splay trees. And this was a big departure from where we were going before. So when we started out with trees, we wanted to run away from this problem that binary search trees have, this normal, plain binary search trees, that we had guarantees on how bad every operation could be. And for AVL and red-black trees, this was log n. We guaranteed every single operation is log n, which for binary search trees was probably your, intuition as far as what should happen, but you know that you can construct scenarios where that doesn't happen. In fact, it's really easy. Like, if you just insert things in sorted order into a binary search tree without doing any balancing, you'll end up with a linked list. So splay trees don't have that guarantee. And instead, we wanted to optimize for repeated access. So we move things to the top of the tree every time we access them. And this meant that even our find operation rearranged the tree. So as far as sort of the constant factor, splay trees seem pretty bad. Because we have this big constant factor as far as what we're doing for every operation. We're always rearranging the tree. And I just told you with red-black trees that that's the good thing to avoid. But the advantage is, if we have this repeated access pattern, then we're gonna do better than we do for even AVL or red-black trees, because everything's near the top. We don't actually get that log n cost. We get something less most of the time if we're lucky enough to have that repeated accesses of things we accessed recently. And we learned that there's a way of analyzing the runtime of splay trees, which shows that splay trees actually aren't that bad, even in their worst case. We can show that they have something we call amortized time, which is a notion of average time. And the average is that we say we start with an empty tree, and we do our bunch of operations, and we look at the average time of any set of operations, no matter how evilly chosen they are, even if we look at the current tree and try to make it a linked list and then try to access the thing at the bottom of the list. Even if we construct our operations in that way, you can do the analysis of splay trees. If you do it more formally, we'll show you that the total time of all the operations together divided by the number of operations is going to be order log n, where n is the maximum size of the tree. And we call this amortized runtime. So it's amortized logarithmic time, even though each of those individual operations, yes, you'll have a case where at some point the tree is a big linked list and you go all the way down it, but the analysis will show that that can't happen often enough, so the average is linear. So any questions about either of these new topics? So we're going to talk a little more about amortized analysis, and we're going to use a much simpler case of amortized analysis, and one that doesn't have to do with trees, but comes up way, way more often. And that's going to be with vector growth. So vector, I mean a dynamic array, like array list in Java. So we have to do an insert, and internally we have just an array of some size, say allocated with new, and if it's not big enough, we need to do something. We run out of space, and probably the simplest thing we can think of doing, and I'll start with, is we just double the capacity. So we allocated 1,000 elements, I try to insert the 1,001th element, I'm gonna just double the size of my array, which means I'm gonna have to copy 1,000 elements into the new array. And so this suggests that, well, it seems like insert is big theta of n, because we care about worst case with big O, and clearly the worst case of any particular insert is that we have to copy the entire n element vector into our new out memory allocation. So that's definitely the worst case, but what about sort of the average case? And we have this intuition that on average this should be really fast, but we want to formalize that and say, well, can we say that in a formal sense, it actually means that we don't end up being linear time? And the way we're gonna do it is we're gonna have this same notion we have for splay trees, that we're gonna say, let's start with an empty vector, and let's do a series of inserts, deletes, whatever, and count sort of the overall runtime and look at the mean of those. And we're going to try to show that that's better than linear. So let's look at what that looks like. Let's take a simple, like, concrete example. Let's say our vector has this policy of we start out with a capacity of 100. And I insert just right in a row 1,600 elements. So what's going to happen is I'm going to go from 100 to 200 capacity, and I have to copy the first 100 elements. Then I'm going to go from 200 to 400 and have to copy the first 200 elements. Then I'm going to go from 400 to 800 and have to copy the first 400 elements, and so on. And it turns out that to insert 1,600 elements, I make 1,500 copies. So I'm writing 1,600 elements the first time and copying 1,500 elements. Like the first 100 elements, I'm copying 1, 2, 3, 4 times. So it's not that I'm copying 1,500 distinct elements, I'm copying an element 1,500 times, some of them multiple times. And you know, this ends up being like 2 operations per insert. So it looks like kind of intuitively that this might mean we don't actually have that linear case bad time, but of course this isn't a very formal way of looking at it. But if we want to make this a little more formal, let's try to write down the formula for what happens here. So here I just did this manually. I said, here's how many times we double, and I count the number that happens each time. So what we can say is that, let's say we start at 1 just to make our analysis easier. If we don't start at 1, well, we're just getting rid of a constant number of inserts in big O, that's not going to matter. That's just like, how do we set our n0 sort of issue. And so we do 1 plus 2 plus 4 plus, n over 4, n over 2, all the way up to n over 2, and certainly no higher copies, because each time we copy twice as much, so we just have this sequence 1 plus 2 plus 4 plus 8 all the way up, potentially up to n. And if you remember from some math class, I hope, that we require, how you do sequence sums, which we probably won't have you do on test, but you know, if you want to prove this formally, that's probably what you're going to do, is you're going to say, I know my sequence sums, so that's how we do it. You'll find out that this is n minus 1 copies. That it's actually linear. You can prove that. So the worst case is still linear, because each insert, you know, one of these inserts triggered this copying n over 2 elements. One of them triggered copying n over 4. So we have plenty of inserts where the time is proportional to the total size. But the overall time is linear. It's n minus 1, which is big theta of n. And if we divide that by n, we get amortized constant time, because the average time per insert, we can guarantee, is going to be constant over just this sequence of inserts starting with an empty vector. Okay. Yes?
Why are you dividing?
Dividing what? Why am I dividing?
The n.
So here I'm saying that we have that n inserts takes big theta of n time. So there's some inserts which take big theta of n. So what we have here is that we have the inserts take 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus like n over 4 plus 1 plus 1 is the time for all the inserts together. So we have some inserts which are our worst case, which are big theta of n. But the total time, this total time here, is actually big theta of n.
Okay.
So even though some of the inserts are big theta of n, the sum of all the inserts is only big theta of n. If all of them were big theta of n, you know, if we didn't have these cases where it was constant time per insert, then clearly the sum would be big theta of n squared for n inserts. We'd have n plus n plus n plus n, or like n over 2 plus n over 2. That would be proportional to n squared, but because most of them are constant time, we can show formally, based on counting how many copies we have overall, that in fact the average insert in this formal sense is constant time. And yeah, so more questions on this? Yeah. So I'm obviously doing this a bit informally, and probably when you take algorithms, they'll go over formal ways of showing this, probably. I'm not actually sure if we require that. But there's more formal ways when you have to prove it, especially when you have to prove amortized time complexity for things which are more complicated than inserting in a vector. You have to track more information, and you have to deal with sequences of like inserts and deletes and things like that. Okay. So this doubling strategy, because we end up with a number of copies which is, you know, proportional to n, our average insert is constant. So does this always happen? Well, not exactly. So let's say we had a different policy. So let's say our policy was every time we want to make the vector bigger, we just add 1,000 to its capacity. In that case, we'd have to do 1,000 copies, then 2,000 copies, then 3,000 copies, all the way up to around n copies. And if you know how to do sums, or you look up how to do sums because you don't remember because it's been so long since you've taken calculus, you'll find out that that's some formula that's basically n squared. So if you just add a constant, no, you don't get constant time per insert. But if you double, it's fine. And sort of the intuition for this is that because we add a constant, we're doing work proportional to n, sort of a number of times proportional to m. Or n over 1,000 times, we're doing work proportional to n. When we add a constant, when we're doubling, we're doing sort of log n times. We're doing work proportional to something like n-ish. And in fact, if you instead multiply by any k greater than 1, so one example would be that, let's say, k equals 1.1, then this policy is plus 10% size. So that might be a policy you have, is instead of doubling and you say, that seems wasteful, I just want to increase the size by 10% when it gets full. Well, if you do that, that still works out because this sum that you have here, where you have, you copy one thing, then you copy k things, then k squared things, and so on. And yes, I know there's some rounding I'm neglecting, but it turns out not to matter. You end up with some formula for what the value of the sum is that's going to be proportional to n. So that ends up being big theta of n, total operation, total copies over all your inserts. So you again have constant time per insert, even if you don't double, instead you multiply by some other value other than 2. So any policy where you increase the size of the vector by a percentage, even though that percentage isn't 100%, you get this amortized constant time. But if you increase it by a constant, then, well, you actually are doing linear work on average per insert. Yes?
So is this saying that like when you increase the vector capacity, is it better to multiply by k instead of just adding 1,000?
Yes, so this says if you're implementing a vector, that your policy should be to increase the size by multiplying by some k, which is saying like make it like some percentage bigger rather than adding a fixed amount. And this is why if you look in the implementation of ArrayList or Vector, they always have a policy like this. Some might double it, some might like make it 50% bigger or something like that, but they always have a policy like this to get good performance. Yes?
What would happen if you have the vector grow proportionally to n squared?
What do you mean proportionally to n squared?
So instead of having to multiply by k, you have to multiply by n.
So the question is, let's say I grow by something which asymptotically is like bigger than k to the n. Well, can we really do any better than average constant time per insert? Not really. So like from an asymptotic point of view, that's not going to be any better and you're just wasting space. Okay, so any other questions about this? This is our brief foray into amortized analysis. If you take a formal algorithms class, probably you'll do like real proofs of amortized analysis and figure out like how do you prove anything for splay trees, which like we didn't go over like what you need to do that because like you have inserts and binds and what happens. But this is important because hey, we use vectors all the time. And we have all these problems where previously you had to say, well, inserting isn't that linear time. And this is why we never care about that. Okay, so that's everything we're going to talk about for trees, kind of, that we really are going to have you do things, since we talked about what trees are basically good for. We're going to have a brief foray into some other applications of trees, just kind of informally. Mostly to say that, well, like how I started, binary search trees aren't our world of trees. We have other types of trees we care about. Let's talk about things that trees aren't good for. So one thing is if you want ordered unsorted lists, then trees, you could figure out a way to put that like in a tree. That's probably not the best choice because trees when they have an order, typically it's like a binary search tree where you have to have some key which specifies the index. Not great. Trees, as you probably are noticing in the lab this week, aren't the simplest things to implement, especially when you have to get beyond binary search trees and want to get that actual good performance. And you actually need to do that in practice because the bad case for binary search trees comes up for real. Because like you have a sorted list that you read, you insert it into a binary search tree without doing balancing, all of a sudden you have a linked list. So you actually need to do what you're doing with the AVL tree, and that's a lot more code. And the AVL tree is basically the simplest one. Maybe there's a different type of balance tree which is a little bit simpler, but it doesn't get much simpler than that. And that's still a lot of cases, and we're not even having you implement the delete, which is more complicated than the insert, I believe. And this is, if you compare to a stack or queue, that's something that once you know what it does is pretty straightforward to implement from memory in a day. I don't think you're likely to implement an AVL tree from memory even after having done it before. At least I wouldn't do that. Trees also, it's all log n time. So if for some reason you care about the difference between theta of log n and theta of 1, then you're going to want something else. And you might say, well, I can't do look up by values or look up by key sort of things in theta of 1 time. We're going to talk next about a data structure which kind of does that, called hash tables. We'll talk about what I mean by kind of. So we looked at trees almost exclusively as a way of storing sorted data. And there are other applications of trees, as I alluded to when I began, when I talked about we have different species, we want to group them together, we can represent that as a tree. And one particular common use of trees is when we want to represent a program. So your compiler typically produces what is known as an abstract syntax tree when it compiles your program. Because this is the most natural representation of our program structure, where we have functions which contain a list of statements, and the statements contain operators, and the operators have you want an expression tree where you show what happens first. And so this is actually the sort of representation that happens in compilers and other similar tools. So here we have our program. At the top level of our tree, we have special nodes because we don't have this sort of sorted order, but we want to represent that the program has some variables and functions, and within the functions, we just make some convention. There's different things different compilers will do. In this case, we're saying our function has a child which shows us, which has the parameters, has a child which has its variables, and a child which has its statements. Other ways we could do that. And the idea is when you want to find out something about the program, or when you want to say generate code that the machine understands, so later we'll talk about assembly, what the compiler is going to do is it's going to traverse through, say, this function. So we're going to look at this function. The compiler is going to have something which first looks at the top node and says, okay, I have a parameter, I'm going to write the code to set that up. Then I have these variables, I'm going to look at all the variables, there happens to be none, I'm going to write the code to set those up, to allocate space for them. Then it goes through this body and it says, I'm going to traverse this in some order, and as I'm doing that, I'm going to write the code for that implements this. Or if we had something like Python where we just execute code, you might execute directly from this form. You might say, I'm going to evaluate the expression based on this, based on what I see in this tree by traversing the tree in a pre-order fashion or something like that. So, so for example, we have this for loop here. in our tree. And, you know, we have this convention that we're going to have our initialization, our condition, our update in our body. And when we're implementing this, this is a convenient thing to implement in our higher level language. We'll probably do something like have a superclass for a node of our abstract syntax tree and have these subclasses for each type of node. Because unlike the sort of trees we've seen before, we have distinctly different types of nodes. And we could imagine that we'd add a methods here, or like, you know, we might have an evaluate method here, which is defined in the parent class. This syntax here, this is inherit extends in C++. We'll talk about that later, much later in the semester. But this is basically for node extends AST node. So we might have evaluate methods. So a common way of implementing this sort of functionality in an object-oriented language is you define a node class and you specialize it for, well, what do we do for a for loop? You just have methods which implement all the things you do for a for loop. And you just have this tree data structure representing our program this way. And when we want to say run the function, we just call evaluate on the first AST node. And presumably evaluate takes arguments about like what the global variables are and things like that. Okay. Questions about this sort of general concept? So yeah, this is, as I said, what's called an abstract syntax tree. You might also hear it called a parse tree, which name is used, probably just depends on what you're trying to do with it. You'll call it a parse tree if you don't actually want to like manipulate the program, more likely. And basically everything we're doing is, you know, that compilers do, or that other things which analyze programs do, can be considered just tree traversals. We just do a tree traversal and we do some operation on that. And you've sort of seen a hint of this, like when you did the expression tree stuff. That's sort of this same idea, and we can extend that to a whole program with multiple statements with different types of tree nodes that aren't just single, you know, either integers or operators. Here we have functions and so on. And one example application of this, which is in Bloomfield's slides, so I will mention it just because to be even, is that this is a way we can compare programs. So one way to compare programs is you just compare text. Another way to compare programs is you look at the abstract syntax tree and you can use it to easily do comparisons where you say you ignore what order functions are in. Or where you ignore variable names. You just compare two trees, and when you just write a compare function, which when it compares things, it compares everything but the names. And it's easy to ignore comments. And so, for example, if you want to detect copy and paste of code, so one application of that is you want to detect plagiarism. Another application of that is that in real software, like commercial software, people often, instead of making something like a library function, they will just copy and paste the code somewhere. And this is a useful thing to know about because, for example, let's say you know the original had a bug fix. This actually happens in real software. Well, it would be nice to have a tool to find that. So if you want to do this, this is a way you would do that. And this survives, like, they reformatted the code to match the style guide, they changed the variable names for a different context, or just to try to deliberately fool people looking at the code. And that's a way you can do that. Bloomfield slides say that Moss does this, and Moss is probably the most commonly used plagiarism detection tool in academia. There's a few others these days, which I believe, but the Moss paper doesn't describe doing this because it describes a different part of how Moss works. And he points to the paper, which is interesting. Okay. So that's what I have about trees with our brief foray into abstract syntax trees. So we're gonna start our next topic, which is gonna be on hash tables. And we're going to start by looking over our abstract data types, because hash tables are going to be a particular kind of abstract data type, which we've been kind of making with trees, but we haven't actually talked about directly. So, like, originally we talked about lists. So we had lists where we could find something by value, we can insert at a particular location in the list, so a list had an order. And we know it had an order because we had an operation where we could, like, supply an index and find a value, and that's n. That should be big. Find a value, and where we could, you know, like, remove by index and so on. So we had those operations, had those sorts of operations, so we know it has an order. We talked about stacks. Stacks had an order, but we only allowed operations on the top. And also, now that we've learned that vectors are amortized constant time, we can say that if you implement a stack with a vector, it's basically as good. Even if we think about expanding the size of the underlying array, as long as you have that add a percentage, you get basically the same runtime as a linked list. And the same thing with queues. So we had these operations. So we're going to mention two data types that I'm going to use the names that the C++ standard library uses for them. And these are abstract data types which we've effectively been implementing but just not naming. So one of them is what I will call sets. And these we can find by value, we can insert an item, and we can remove it, but we don't have any notion of an item being at a particular index. And you can think of your trees, your binary search trees, as implementing this set abstract data type. Right, we can find values, we can insert values, we can remove values, but we don't have a notion of a first or a last value. We can find the minimum or maximum efficiently on a tree, but, you know, we don't actually have an order that's preserved, unlike lists. And we can think of our various implementations of sets. So our binary search tree, well, if the height remains small, it's order proportional to the height, which is small. If it becomes large, that's about as big O of n. With AVL or red block, we remember it's all log of n. And if we can implement this with a vector, we probably wouldn't, because most of our operations are, I guess this probably should be even, are pretty bad. That's probably not even big theta of one sometimes, maybe, if you like swap, I guess it's big theta of one because you can swap in an element. So that actually is true. But we have sort of, you know, bad performance for find and find max here. So that's not so great for a vector, which is why we're talking about binary trees for this. So later on in this class and the next, we'll talk about hash tables, which are another option for implementing this sort of data structure. And they have, according to this chart, but there's a caveat, they kind of have constant time find, constant time insert, constant time remove, but they're not sorted. So we don't get fast find max or min. If you want to find the max or min, we basically need to search everything. So there's a caveat there. So with the binary search tree, our caveat is, well, the height, what is it? Maybe it's log n, but it could often be big theta of n. With the hash table, it's usually going to be constant time, but there's a worst case where it's linear time. And the worst case for a hash table, if we do things right, is going to be much rarer than the worst case for a binary search tree. The worst case for a hash table is going to be something much more convoluted than let's insert all the items in sorted order. It's going to be something that hopefully will not happen by accident almost ever. But it is going to be the case that if you really care about that worst case, you're probably not going to use a hash table. So there's a second abstract data type we're going to talk about, which is maps. And I'm mostly going to sort of talk at the same time about maps and sets. The key idea to remember is, well, you know, maps are, we have a key and a value. So like have a computing ID and a grid, or a word and a definition. And we can use our implementation of sets to implement maps. What we do is we just say, when we're figuring out whether two values are the same and comparing them, we only look at the key. But we actually store a key and a value together. And so everything that you use to implement sets, you can use to implement maps. It's just a matter of whether you just store a key or you store the key and the value. And whenever you're figuring out where something is, say in the tree, you only look at the key. So to give an example of that with the stupid way of implementing a map, let's say we could have store a key and a value, you know, a computing ID and a grade, and we could just have a vector of these, and that would implement it. And if we just got rid of the value, this would implement a set. So essentially, our maps are just going to be sets where we store a key value pair, and our comparison function for a key value pair just ignores half of the pair. And that means we get essentially the same runtimes. Okay. And as I said, I'm giving you these names because these are what the C++ standard library uses. So, in the C++ standard library, there's a class called map. And map is a balanced tree-based map. It has to be balanced tree-based, effectively, because it's guaranteed to be sorted. So the standard doesn't actually say compilers must implement this as a balanced tree, but it's really hard to implement a sorted map without having it be a balanced tree and have it be as efficient as is required. There's also a class called unordered map, which in some older things you might see with other names, like hash map, which is usually a hash table based map. And you can see the syntax here, so we make an unordered map, we can set values using it like kind of like an array, but it takes the key type. We can ask for the count of values. We can iterate through it. It's just a container type that works. And similarly, there are set types. So there's set and unordered set. So set is a hash tree-based set, and unordered set is a hash table-based set. Any questions on these? Okay, so I've given our sort of setting for hash tables. So hash tables are going to be our second good implementation of an abstract data type, of these abstract data types set in map. So let's go over the basic idea of how hash tables are going to work. We're going to have an array of some size. Typically, we're going to choose that to be larger than the number of things we want to store. And typically, we're actually going to choose a prime number size that is larger than the number of things we want to store. We'll talk later a bit about why a prime size. And we're going to choose a hash function. And the hash function is going to take all our possible keys. So if we have like computing IDs that we want to store, we're going to take all possible strings that could be a computing ID. And we're going to map them to, using this hash function, we're going to map them to a particular place in this array. And hash tables working well is going to depend on us choosing good hash functions. That's how we're going to usually get our constant time. If we choose a bad hash function, we're going to get linear time. So let's talk about, you know, what our hash function is going to look like. So it's going to take our key, and it's going to output an unsigned integer. And typically what we're going to do is we're going to have a hash function, which outputs an unsigned integer, which is any unsigned integer, pretty much. And then we're going to take the mod of the table size to actually use that to map to a particular table entry. So like if I have a string, I'll have a hash function which takes a string and gives me a number between 0 and 4 billion. And then I'll take that number between 0 and 4 billion, and if I have a table with, say, 100 entries, I'll take it mod 100 and use that entry of the table. And this we'll call the bucket where we're going to store information for that key. That's where we're going to look to see if that key is in the table. Since we have this function which takes a key, which is, say, in this case, a string, and outputs an integer, well, there are more strings than unsigned integers. Because, you know, in C, if we're thinking of like an unsigned long even, an unsigned long, it has a lot of possible values, a real lot. But I can have like a 1,000-character string. There are way, way more 1,000-character strings. So clearly, there are multiple things which map to the same bucket. And we're going to hope that doesn't happen. And we'll talk later about what we're going to do when that does happen, because it will happen occasionally, especially since we have only, say, 100 buckets, if we have a size 100 hash table. So it's going to happen. We're going to do something about it. And that's the case where our hash table is going to be slow. So we're going to try to choose our hash function so that when we do this operation, we very rarely end up with two keys trying to use the same bucket. So we need some properties for our hash function to work. So one is a correctness property. And this is a must property. So our hash function, our hash table won't be slow if we don't do this necessarily. It will be wrong. Like, we'll insert a key, we'll try to find the same key, and we won't get it. And this property is it has to be deterministic. It needs to actually be a function. We can't just return a random number. We need to actually use the key to get our value. And this is important because the other properties are going to really tempt you to say, let's just return a random number. But no, we can't do that. The result needs to be evenly distributed. So this is a should be. So if we don't do this, our hash table will behave correctly, unlike the deterministic. Like, we'll insert a value, we'll find it. It just might be really slow. And this is going to give us our property that two keys are unlikely to share the same bucket. And a way you can think about this happening is that we're going to take a key, and each key has the same chance of going into any bucket effectively. We're going to choose our hash function so every bucket is evenly used. And that means if we take two keys at random, their chances of sharing the bucket are, you know, as low as it can be. If we have 100 buckets, it should be a 1% chance that if I have one key and I look at another key, that they have the same bucket. Another property we're going to want is that it should be fast. We're going to want to take the hash of strings a lot, or keys a lot, and we don't want to spend a lot of time doing that. So we don't want something really slow, even if it's very nicely distributed. And this is sort of in conflict with that, because ways of having the values be nicely distributed might be slow. So I note here that deterministic, so this means that a correct hash function would be like return 0. Like, that is a correct hash function. Because it follows the must be property. It must be deterministic. Yep, return 0, that's deterministic. And even as fast, return 0 is real, real fast. But it's not evenly distributed. All our values hash to bucket 0. That's going to be real bad. But that's a correct hash function, and our hash table will produce the correct results. But it happens that if we choose that hash function, our hash table's performance is going to end up being linear time. So let's think about like some examples of what might be a good hash function. So we have these properties. We want it to be deterministic. We want it to be evenly distributed. And we want it to be fast. So here we go. Let's say I'm going to hash people to something. And I have like a class person. And I decide I'm going to use the birth date field because I assume that doesn't change. You know, I'm worried about using the name field because I know that names change. I don't want to have to move things around in my hash table. So I'm going to use that. I want to make a hash function based on the birth date. So here are some options. So make a decision about which of these do you think is best. Like order these by how good you think they are. And try to see if your neighbor agrees on the order. We'll give you a few minutes. And since I said try to see if your neighbor agrees, you are absolutely allowed to talk.
I should.
For C, the date is the full year, month, day. That's a Leica. Okay, so as we finish up, someone wanted to have opinions, share some opinions on this. I realize I should have looked at the total time. Yeah.
Anything that includes years is not good because everyone in this room can be born plus or minus 1 year.
Okay, so you say anything that includes year. So that's one way. So that means that this first one is pretty bad, right? Because there's lots of the same year in our data set, most likely. But that doesn't mean if we add other things, like the year probably doesn't hurt so much. Because remember, we're taking mod of the table size afterwards. So it doesn't matter that our values all fall around 1,000, not a big deal. And I guess time-wise, we'll probably talk about this beginning of class next time. We'll revisit this. So that's one thing to think about. And yeah, we'll go over all of these next time, since I assume people would be angry if I just kept talking for 5 minutes.